with flood damage prevention. Mr. Manager?
Okay. This first hearing is for a mapping of area regulatory floodplains that has been recently updated, and federal rules dealing with floodway and floodplain management have been revised. Draft ordinance amending the Carrboro Land Use Ordinance flood damage prevention provisions has been prepared for the board to review. It is necessary for the Board of Aldermen to receive public comment before taking any action, and Trish McGuire, Planning Administrator, is here to give the board a presentation concerning the ordinance changes. Trish?
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Carrboro has participated in the federal flood insurance program for going on 30 years now, and has had a fairly rigorous implementation of that program during that period of time. The implementation has resulted in a fairly low number of claims made in the flood insurance program, less than $10,000 during that period of time. So it's been an effective program, we would say. The update that is before you represents revisions to mapping and floodplain regulations. Specifically, mapping was completed after a number of years in 2005, and the maps were distributed for comment through early the spring of this year. There have been changes, as I mentioned, in regulations and in the implementation or administration of the program at the state level, particularly the development of a state model ordinance for flood damage prevention, and those changes have necessitated the draft ordinance that we have before you this evening. In light of the schedule that's been established for adoption and implementation of these new regulations, the draft ordinance is action on the draft ordinance and adoption of it is needed before February 2nd, 2007. Oops, not a word up here. We have gone during this period of time, the maps we have or effective 1980 from two map panels, this illustrates one of them, to eight. We now have eight what are called D firms, digital firms. These are maps that are not just on paper but are provided digitally, and we have draft versions of them currently and are able to incorporate them into the town's GIS to make them overlay with our other data and make them very widely accessible to the community and for the use by the town in reviewing development projects. The updated mapping is a result of several things. First of all, it represents more detailed information at a smaller scale, so a lot better, clearer understanding of how it affects individual properties. It incorporates a number of the approved letters of map amendment that have been, or map revision rather, that have been adopted over the years at the request of the town for it, in relation to how the floodplain maps were affecting properties throughout our jurisdiction. And the floodplain mapping has been extended upstream beyond the drainages of 1 square mile, which is the previous definition of the floodplain area that was regulated by FEMA's FEMA and flood protection. And those areas have been designated as special flood hazard areas per the request of the town and are now subject to the regulations, the federal regulations. The draft ordinance, as a result of the state developing a model ordinance and our need to comply with that model ordinance, this is a different, this ordinance is different in structure and in its operation. It has a lot of definitions included within the article. It has use provisions. It has certification provisions. It has administrative mechanisms, all in that section of the ordinance. Currently, our Unified Development Ordinance splits those provisions up into a number of different sections, either an appendix or in the body of the ordinance in different places. This pulls them all together in one place. It will make it and makes it straightforward for the review by the state floodplain mapping staff to determine its compliance with state and federal regulations. There is an increase, as I just mentioned, in the number of defined terms, a significant increase there. Most notable is the shift from the term floodplain that previously has referred to the regulatory floodplain to the term special flood hazard area. So we're having to adjust in the way we think about how these regulations are going to affect properties and how we implement this ordinance. It's kind of a small change, but it's a big one in terms of just remembering it. So there are specific purposes spelled out for the flood damage prevention provisions. And there are two principal substantive changes that are included in this draft, and they are that there is a requirement for the 2-foot elevation of structures on lots with special flood hazard areas, and that's 2 foot of elevation above the base flood elevation, the 100-year flood elevation. The state recommends this. The federal government does not require it. They require elevation to the base flood elevation, to the base flood height. The second change is the requirement for elevation certificates where special flood hazard areas are present, just not only when you are proposing to develop within one, but when one is present on a lot, so that that relationship between the special flood hazard area and the structure that's being constructed is clear.
Just a real quick question there. Who issues the elevation certificates?
Elevation certificates are prepared by surveyors when a house has a finished floor elevation, and I think they're usually required to be submitted if it's right now as part of the getting a certificate of occupancy.
Okay.
Thank you. We review them. And there are procedures spelled out in this draft ordinance that that specify what the process will be for submitting. Well, this is sort of a process that we currently use to make sure that the finished floor elevation will be appropriate in terms of meeting the flood elevation requirements. And so the ordinance, though, spells out exactly what kind of information is needed at the submittal of a building permit application, what is needed at the time of foundation survey is going to occur, what's needed at the end. A couple of notes regarding adoption. This draft ordinance is more stringent than that required by federal regulations or recommended by the state's model ordinance. That is the case with our current ordinance and practice, and the staff has included additional provisions to reflect those in this draft as well. There is a typo in Section 251.2b, which is the section I described in the abstract as one that we had removed from the draft ordinance because the staff wants to consider it further. But there is a reference to three types of special flood hazard areas, and it should say two. And the DFIRM, the digital flood insurance rate map that is attached, is illustrative. It is not the regulatory piece. The actual map, the final versions aren't available yet, so we just wanted to include it so you'd see what, and everyone would be able to see what those maps are going to look like. And as I mentioned earlier, the effective date of the ordinance is February 2nd, 2007. That's the date that is proposed in the draft in front of you, per the information we've received from the North Carolina Emergency Management Floodplain Management Branch. In terms of recommendations on the draft ordinance, we have submitted this to the Floodplain Management Branch of NCEM for their review. We haven't received comments from them. This Planning Board and the EAB have reviewed this and have recommended adoption of it. We have submitted it also to Orange County, but have not received comments from them. The staff is recommending adoption of the resolution that supports adoption of the ordinance and the adoption of the ordinance itself. I'm happy to try and answer any questions about this.
Trish, will those maps will be available on the internet?
They are now available.
That are ready. So
the drafts are available currently on the internet.
Right. This will be under the planning, I guess, GIS.
Well, they're not on our website right now. We did post them during the review period, so that was part of the requirement that we post them and ask for comments. We don't have them posted right now, but they are available on the North Carolina Emergency Management Floodplain Management Branch website. And I can provide that information to anyone, the link, if anybody wants to take a look at them. They're available for the entirety of the state, the drafts.
Dan, did you we do have one citizen signed up, but let me just ask you maybe you've addressed this and I'm just dense and didn't quite figure it out, but so if you owned a building lot that had been approved a long time ago and happens to be largely or entirely in the 100-year floodplain according to new maps, you're saying that would mean that the building site is probably in the special flood hazard area. And you would have to build your house elevated at least 2 feet above that 100-year floodplain?
The finished floor elevation for the living level would need to be elevated to that regulatory flood protection elevation under this ordinance.
And I guess my question is, certainly I can understand how that well, can you help me understand? So, but if, it's kind of one thing where if the lot entirely or mostly falls within the floodplain, so that the 100-year floodplain, so that you don't, there's not much you can do, you don't have a whole lot of choices about where to build the house. But if somebody had a lot that, was 50%, hypothetically 50% in the floodplain and 50% out of it, do we have anything that would require them to choose to be outside the floodplain? Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, the ordinance prohibits development within the floodplain.
Okay, this is only for the sort of non-conform. This only addresses not basically like non-conforming situations, or.
Well, no. I mean, the ordinance says that if you have the floodplain, the special flood hazard area on your lot, then there will be an effect on your construction, your development activity, and that the finished floor elevation is going to have to be elevated above that base flood elevation.
Whether the footprint of the house itself is in the 100-year floodplain or not. Okay.
Correct. So it does that. And the ordinance, as our ordinance does now, development within the floodplain is prohibited. There are some exceptions to that, but we don't allow development within the floodplain, and that's one of the ways that our ordinance is more strict than the federal government. The federal law prohibits development within the floodway itself, which is a piece of the floodplain where a model has been done to show a certain amount of elevation of the stormwater. It's basically taking the whole floodplain and kind of squishing it into a channel in the middle and raising it up, and capturing it all there. So the federal law allows development within the floodplain, but not within the floodplain. It allows development within the floodplain, but not the floodway.
Right.
Our ordinance prohibits development within both. There are some provisions for crossing the floodway, crossing the floodplain, and some other things like that. But we go beyond that. I mean, our ordinance has always gone beyond the federal regulations in this regard.
And the other question, and this might be more for the attorney, but I know there are circumstances where, for example, if a house in a non-conforming house, say it's too close to a setback boundary or something like that, burns down, it can be built back basically where it was before as a matter of right under our ordinance, I believe. That's my understanding anyway.
Yes. That's correct.
And so the same thing would be true with the house that, for example, is partly in the floodway now?
That is the case. There are provisions for, non-conforming situations to be replaced. The broadest opportunity applies to single-family residential buildings. There are some more controls on the way that a building could be reconstructed if it was a commercial building or if it was a multifamily residential building.
Yeah, I'm talking more about
single-family residences. There are provisions that deal with that. And this draft ordinance, if I could just open it to that page and look at it. The draft ordinance speaks specifically to this as well.
And I'm assuming so. We don't have to explore every angle of this, but I guess what I'm trying to get to there is just that. So if somebody has a right to rebuild in the floodplain because that's where their house was before, but still, if they're rebuilding, then presumably the 2 foot above rule applies. So they
yes.
can build back where they were, but
right.
it's going to have to, may have to be higher than it was before.
Yes,
that's right.
Okay.
That's what it says.
All right. That's what I was trying to get a feel for. We do have one citizen signed up to speak on this. Well, actually, it's James Carnahan, but I'm just kidding. Come on up, James.
He's still a citizen. And it could be that the item that I wanted to speak on is actually no longer in the draft ordinance. You said that 15-251.2, this should now read two times.
Yeah, this is
so this is out for that?
Yes, it is.
My comments are
really James, all right. Could you stay up there a second? I was curious if there was a particular reason that why Deborah Fritz abstained from this vote. Did she have a concern about it?
Yeah, and I was going to get into that, but it's the part that this it's the piece thing. That's been pulled out, which is extending our area of interest even further up the watershed. So we had a long conversation about that, and it was late at night and late in the process. I might well have preferred to be an abstention also. And what I was coming to ask was that if this was to remain in here, that you might want to ask to see maps to show the extent of that particular provision. But it's not in the ordinance for the time being, so it is moved.
All right. Well, we we'll look forward to seeing you on the next item, James. All right. Great. Thanks.
Sure. Thank you.
Need to close the public hearing.
I think we can move straight to adoption.
I think
in this case.
Go ahead, Steve.
Good. I'll second.
Since we haven't heard back from Orange County, Trish, don't you think?
Not Orange County, from the state.
From the state. I'm sorry. Shouldn't we delay or not?
I mean, we could.
I mean, it's not effective until February 2nd.
So should we continue the public hearing?
I don't think there's any need to continue
the
public hearing.
No need to do that.
I think what we need to do is just bring it back sometime in January, basically.
Probably after we hear them, just because if they have a few minor word changes, then you wouldn't have to want to go through the whole public hearing process again. We could make minor changes in it in the draft without going through another public hearing.
Okay.
So I think we need to do nothing? Is that it?
Yeah. I think we're on agenda item A2 then.
Is where we are.
Thank you.
A2 is a public hearing on a land use ordinance text amendment to modify the design standards for collector streets. Mike Hammersley, on behalf of the Chapel Hill Carver City Schools, has requested an amendment to the land use ordinance to modify the minimum centerline radius for collector streets.
I think that's A3.
I think you're skipping ahead of one here.
Oh, am I?
This should be on temporary lodging. We have that
temporary
as number
lodging
two.
Is number
Sorry
two.
About that. I've got the wrong copy, I guess. Pardon me. This is the public hearing on a land use ordinance text amendment to establish a new use classification for temporary lodging. The Board of Aldermen has scheduled a public hearing on a land use ordinance text amendment to establish a new use classification for temporary lodging. It's necessary for the board to receive public comment before taking any action. And Trish is still at the podium to give an overview of this request.
Maybe we could get her a stool up there. She's going to be there for a while.
Going to go straight to the meat of the matter for this one. This is a text amendment that was submitted by Laura Van Sant on behalf of Main Street Properties, and it is to the request was framed around creating an exemption for hotels and motels from the ground floor residential prohibition that you in the B1C zoning district that the board has considered recently. And the amendment request that was submitted makes several describes this use, makes several points about how a temporary lodging use like a hotel and motel is different from an ongoing residential type of use. And there are other issues as well beyond those noted in the amendment request that the staff has noted about these, the way these uses are regulated, the way they're taxed, and so forth, that does further does support the fact that these are different from regular residential uses. We have for many years included them as a residential use within our residential use classification. But in considering the request and thinking about these other elements of the use, it seemed appropriate to rather than proposing an exemption to the ground floor residential prohibition, to take a different approach. And that, did you want me?
I just wanted a clarification of a term before we go any further. What is a temporary residence if not a hotel, motel, or B&B?
We also have a use that would be a boarding house type of use. I mean, just look at the existing draft or, I mean, existing ordinance provisions.
So
an extended stay type of place is another type of temporary lot residence that is not, I mean, that's not grouped in the same. I mean, they're grouped currently together in the residential residential use classification.
It may be that as this discussion winds up that I would like to make an argument for removing that from this if it passes, because I think that's a real different animal than the other things that we're discussing. But go on, and I just want to make sure that I was clear on what we meant by that.
Okay. Absolutely. So the ordinance has been drafted to create a new classification for temporary lodging that removes these the hotel and motel uses specifically and the bed and breakfast uses from our residential use classification, and then establishes screening and associated parking requirements for the new use classification. Mm-hmm. And it does propose within the B1C specifically that this use be permitted with a conditional use permit. We've also noted some changes that would seem to be beneficial in your in light of the existing in light of the way the uses are assigned permit requirements currently. And so we are proposing that the bed and breakfast specifically be permitted in the B2 zoning district with a special use permit. Currently, hotels and motels are permitted there with but not bed and breakfast. It seems an appropriate use to allow in the B2 zoning district. And also the same is true for the CT zoning district because of the fact that both of those districts lie on the edge of the core commercial areas in the downtown and are right next to residential neighborhoods. So bed and breakfast use seems to be appropriate. That is true as well. The bed and breakfast also seems to be an appropriate use within the University Lake watershed, since it will be subject to the impervious surface limitations that would go along with it, and with a conditional use permit requirement, it would go through a very high level of scrutiny. The ordinance has been referred for advisory board review. The planning board has made a recommendation in relation to this draft ordinance. They are requesting that the board consider another text amendment to the definition of the bed and breakfast use itself. That definition currently, which was established right around the time of adoption here, but back in 1999, the provision that the planning board is concerned about, they're asking that the board consider eliminating the provision that requires that residential use structures be have been in place as of January 1, 1999, so to be able to be bed and breakfast. That's a condition that we have in our current definition. But otherwise, they've recommended in favor of it. I believe the Economic Sustainability Commission also reviewed this as well and made a recommendation in support of it, but there is not one in your packet, and I have not seen it. So this was submitted to Orange County for review as well. The staff recommendation is in favor of the change that is before the board this evening. Happy to try and answer any questions.
We have two people signed up to speak on this item. So, James Carnahan.
Yes, what came to the attention of the planning board in the course of considering this was the definition of bed and breakfast, which is not specifically a part of the amendment that you're looking at this evening, but we would ask you to think about. And that is the requirement that any building that might be used for a bed and breakfast would have to be built before January 1, 1999. It seemed arbitrary to us that, and particularly now that any bed and breakfast operation would be subject to a special use permit, we would like to suggest just striking that language from the definition. The rest of the definition are the specifics of what you would expect to find in a B&B. And one issue that you might want to think about was whether somebody who was building a new structure could build a new structure from the ground up with the intention of using it from day one as a bed and breakfast, or whether you always want there to be some kind of a time lag. But it seemed that limiting this only to structures built before this date was kind of arbitrary, and that's the extent of our recommendation. Otherwise, we are very enthusiastic about this amendment.
I think that's an interesting that's an interesting issue to discuss, but I think maybe that's an issue to be since it would involve a text amendment, and I remember why it was written the way it was written, but that sounds like another agenda item, not tonight's agenda item.
We understood that. It wasn't clear whether or not the definition could be considered part of the ordinance. That you would have to ask the attorney for that, and I would understand why you might, especially if you were involved in the original discussions. Remind us what this relates to.
Well, I think I'm sorry.
It appears to be billed as a public hearing, at least on our agenda. It says public hearing on land use ordinance text amendment to establish new use classification for temporary lodging, which seems narrowly enough focused that I don't know, Mr. Attorney, what you think about whether that gives the public adequate notice that we might consider a matter like this.
Probably not. I think probably the thing to do if the board wants to pursue that is just include that on Marty's list.
Marty's rather long list.
Is among the miscellaneous things that will be coming back as a potential change, unless you want to sort of accelerate that. But I mean, I think it's considered a part. I would agree that it's not covered by that notice.
Okay, so we're probably not in a position to take any action, adopt anything with regard to that tonight, because our public hearing notice doesn't really put the public on notice about that.
But maybe we could still hear from Jackie as to why that.
Well, let me suggest this. How about if we decide what we're going to do with the temporary lodging issue first, and then we'll come back to James's or the planning board's issue in just a moment.
Okay.
So, what are we going to do with that?
What was
your concern about it?
Excuse
me. Laura Van Sant has signed up to speak.
Sorry.
Why don't we hear from Laura?
Hi, Laura.
And then we'll turn to this topic in just a moment.
I'm going to just very briefly say that obviously I'm in support of this. This is a slightly different approach than we had requested, but it accomplishes what we're looking for, so we're happy with it.
Can you just elaborate on what you are looking for?
We are looking for a way to put a hotel in 300 East Main without having to build an associated ball field, set aside open space, et cetera. So getting rid of some of the requirements that accompany residential uses.
Oh, I see.
And the first floor issue as well, right?
The first floor issue, that may or may not be an issue in our particular plan, but it potentially is, so yeah.
I see. Okay.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay. Now, Jackie.
Okay. I have no problems with the ordinance change in general. I would simply like to see removed from it the temporary residences. I think it's fine to have hotels, motels, and bed and breakfasts without redefining bed and breakfast, but to remove the temporary residences, because I think things like rooming houses are a different animal than, because they really tend to be not truly temporary. They tend to be long-term housing issues.
So could somebody from the planning staff address that point? For example, the Chan building on Rosemary Street, does that fall in one point?
This is really – the temporary residence is intended to – I mean, this tourist home use is like an extended stay motel. It's that type of temporary lodging.
Yeah.
It's not – intended to be, you mean the single room occupancy units.
Right.
I don't know the rental structure over there at the Chan property. So I would have to look into that further to be able to respond, you know, to your question.
But I think anything that has its own kitchen probably shouldn't fall, you know, like an extensive kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Well,
like an embassy suites kind of hotel that has a kitchen.
Yeah. Mm. Maybe that's not what I'm thinking.
It does specify, Jackie, in the ordinance language, for relatively short periods of time. That's how it's defined.
But it doesn't define. You know, you could say a year is a relatively short period of time, since most people live in apartments longer. I don't see the reason for including it, because I see it as being something like really different than a tourist or people that aren't going to be in town long.
I'm trying to understand what the fear is or the issue is. Would like in town, Chapel Hill in town, be that considered temporary? Like my in-laws comes, you know, I cannot feed them in my house, so they have to stay somewhere else. This is a good thing. And, you know, stay for a week or whatever. Is that, that's the sort of thing we're looking?
I'm not familiar with that particular business, but it is a temporary, it's an extended stay kind of tourist home that has folks staying. And they usually do have some kind of kitchen facilities in them.
Chapel Hill in town, for what it's worth, is basically, it's like they're two-bedroom apartments is what they are, but they're just rented by the, you can rent them by the day or by the week or whatever.
We don't have a definition for, I'm pretty sure, for tourist home. It's not included within our, let me just double check, within our residential use definitions, and we don't have a separate definition for it. So, I mean, if a concern was about the length of time, we could create a definition that did limit it.
I guess as there's a lot of change happening and a lot of building going on, I kind of have my antenna up for having as few loopholes as possible in our ordinance, to guard against five story student housing or something along those lines. And I know there are places where the temporary hotels they're not here, but there are other municipalities, other places where the temporary suites have been converted into student housing, and I have nothing against student housing. I just don't see the reason for that definition being part of this, and so I would be more comfortable, because I see it as a potential loophole, I'd be more comfortable taking it out.
We did include it because, in some cases it does seem to be a benefit to provide an extended stay kind of lodging for folks who are coming to the community for training or for, you know, visiting or that sort of thing. So it was included to be kind of create that consistent.
But there's really nothing to prevent a regular hotel from sticking a kitchen in. It wouldn't prevent that. It would still be a hotel room, right?
Yes.
It would still be a hotel room. So yeah. I'm not comfortable with that loophole floating out there.
Calling it that.
And if there was ever somebody that had a really good argument for why they wanted to do that, and they could, you know, in a permit, you know, convince us that it was going to be what it was going to be, and it was going to be that forever, then I might feel more comfortable. But I just don't see any reason for it being in there.
Now, let me just clarify. So whether the 1.500 temporary residences are included here or not would have to do not so much with where they're allowed as with what the screening requirements would be. Is that right or no?
See
what I'm saying?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Let me try and take a stab at that to a certain extent. This is not adding a new category of use.
Right.
It already exists.
Right.
It does make some changes, or it proposes to make some changes in where they are allowed.
Temporary residences,
The tourist homes and other temporary residences running rooms for relatively short periods of time is a classification we already have in our ordinance and is already permissible in a number of places.
Right.
So all this moving it into a new category does do a couple of things. It means that this would not be subject, if it moves from the residential to this new category, it would mean that it would not then be subject to the prohibition that we have on residential uses in the first floor. So they could be, they could exist on the first floor of buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have that, but it, and I guess it would also mean that they wouldn't be subject to any
open space,
any open space or other requirements.
And they could be in B1C and B1G, which they cannot right now, is that right? Did I follow that question?
Yes. I mean, one alternative, if there were lack of comfort with the changes in where they're located, one alternative would be just to move them into this category and leave the existing uses the way they are. That doesn't change anything. In other words, if you did that, for example, if you just took the existing category with its existing, the existing column as it exists in the table and move it from where it is now to this new category, then the only change you would make with respect to that would be that they would not be subject to the prohibition on being located on the first floor of places where they're already allowed, which would only be the B2 in terms of commercial. Well, in fact, they wouldn't have any impact, because right now, if you did just that, they're not permissible currently.
In the places where you're not allowed to do.
In the places where you have that limitation, so it wouldn't have that limit. So the only thing that you would do if you just lifted them wholesale from point A to point B, so to speak, in the table of permissible uses,
mm-hmm.
is that you would then, they wouldn't be subject to recreation requirements, which don't make a lot of sense for them anyway.
Assuming, and I think this is Jackie's point, assuming that they're being used, you know, that they're sort of legitimately being used the way that they're sort of intended. Do you know Embassy Suites? Somebody mentioned Embassy Suites earlier. Do you know, have you ever... familiar with that kind of business? I guess this is my question: what is your thinking about that? Is that something that we would probably classify as a hotel?
Clearly a hotel. It's not a tourist home. I mean, we don't have definitions in these things, and one of the reasons, two things you said. The lack of definition stems to when we drafted the ordinance, which is, 26 years ago, I guess?
Right.
And also, we haven't had one in those 26 years. Clearly Embassy Suites would not be a tourist home.
Right.
It would not be regarded, you know, there's some common element of definition. Tourist homes typically are, you know, smaller sorts of things. They would, the Embassy Suites would clearly be in a hotel category. We don't have a definition of a hotel either.
Okay.
But it's sort of, I think we would then apply the duck tests to these things.
Right. Okay. Right. Well, I wouldn't want to hear somebody say that Embassy Suites would be out of the question or something, but
no, I'm not saying that. I just
right. I don't think you are.
I think it just leaves a door open for 5-story efficiency apartments to be built under, with residences on the first floor.
And sort of build initially as one thing
and then
kind
switch.
Of becoming
just,
something else over time.
It's too loophole-y for me.
What would be a legal way to stop
to take this out of there?
Well, we could just leave 1.5 where it is, mm-hmm. is one thing.
And
so it'd still be allowed, just wouldn't be allowed in B1C or B1G, we wouldn't be changing the screening requirements.
Well, this is the existing ordinance here, and the blue are the changes. This is the part of the table that we're really moving right here. And so...
Can you scoot it over just a little bit?
Sure.
You get the text cut off a little
bit. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
Oops.
That's good.
Okay. So you can see we did increase... We did, in looking at the table, we did increase the locations where those tourist homes could be permitted. And so you could just amend this draft ordinance to still move it. I mean, again, the argument for moving it is because you then create an opportunity for small tourist homes. You could see they're allowed in a number of residential districts. You could allow that use without the rec facilities requirements and open space, so not treating it as a residential use. And then you could just, but you could take out, if it's a concern about the five stories in the downtown piece, that really becoming a massing of a temporary, you know, a small rental kind of apartment or efficiency and so forth, you could just change this draft ordinance so that these Cs here in the B1C and the B1G, where we propose to add that tourist home use, you could just remove that. I mean, and still... you have many options, of course, but that is one way to still move it if you wanted to. Otherwise, you'll leave it behind. You can leave it behind.
Could move 1.51 and 1.53 and leave 1.52 where it is, for example.
Which I would be most comfortable doing.
Could we get some, would it be irregular to get some comment from the parties that requested this change in the first place about this?
It wouldn't affect them.
Hey, but I want to hear them say that.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, our interest is simply in having a hotel. Now, I would hope that you would include something with a kitchen could still be a hotel, because many hotels now have suites that do have small kitchen facilities, and the hotel we're contemplating would have some suites in it. But as long as you leave the hotel 1.510 consistent with the proposal, then that's the other one doesn't affect us at all.
Okay.
Thanks, Laura.
Mr. Attorney, do you think we could draft something right now that would leave 1.52 behind and move the other two?
You could just essentially, if you're wanting to go the way Ms. Gist is suggesting, in terms of not changing the uses, you have two choices. One is to move the existing line to this line, keeping the uses the same. And the other is just to leave it where it is. And neither one of those accomplishes the same thing with respect to the uses. The only difference between those two alternatives is if you move it, it then essentially makes the tourist homes and temporary residences no longer subject to the open space and recreation provisions, which they really weren't intended to apply to them anyway. So, but it's either one in terms of the uses amounts to the same thing. So, yes, you could do it without. I don't think it requires any further drafting. We could just. Whichever way you want to do it, you adopt a motion that way, we'll understand how to change the ordinance.
I've got to say, I just for whatever it's worth, my perspective is that I suppose under a more specific set of facts, I'd be willing to consider moving 1.52, but it doesn't really, there's no, it is fundamentally a residential use in a way that it seems to me that hotels and B&Bs are not, and it's not really a change that anybody requested particularly, all other things being equal, I guess it makes sense to me to just leave it behind and simply say that we'll move hotels and bed and breakfast and
that's the cleanest way to do it.
Well, is there a motion? We don't need to close the public hearing particularly. Is there a motion?
Move to close public hearing.
Well, do we have to specify what Mike was just saying about that we want to?
Well, we'll need a motion. We do not need to close the public hearing because it's not a quasi-judicial hearing.
So let me try. I move the amendment with the deletion of with the deletion of 1.52.
Yeah. With the deletion of 34.200.
Right.
Which is the tourist homes.
Right. And leaving 1.52 in the table as it currently stands.
And I take
it
that would include any renumbering because...
Right.
So we'd have 34.100 and 34.2 rather than having a gap.
I'll second that.
You guys are making me crazy. Okay. Thank you, Randy. Yeah.
We love renumbering in the legal biz.
You're just spinning my little dyslexic head all over the place.
All right, and so there was a second from Randy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed are passed unanimously. Now, Mr. Manager, I knew you've been dying to get to these collector's streets.
Yeah, I was just, I wanted to get this so badly. this is a public hearing on a land use ordinance text amendment to modify the...
Oh, well, yeah, you have to adopt the resolution.
Oh, why are we doing this?
Saying why you're doing this.
So you move the resolution.
So I move the why are we doing this resolution.
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passes unanimously. The world will have a record. Now, Mr. Manager.
Okay.
Collector Streets.
This is the text amendment to modify the design standards on collector streets. We'll try again. Mike Hammersley, on behalf of the Chapel Hill Carver City Schools, has requested an amendment to the land use ordinance to modify the minimum centerline radius for collector streets. Draft ordinance has been prepared, and it's necessary for the Board of Aldermen to receive public comment before taking any action. And Trish is still at the podium, and I think this is your last item, Trish.
Yes, thank you. Let's see. This is a text amendment that has been submitted on behalf of the elementary school number 10, which is going through the conditional use permit application process, in which you're going to discuss in just a few minutes, hear about their, where they are. The current regulations for collector streets specify a 250-foot centerline curve radius, and the development of the elementary school site does involve the extension of the Lake Hogan Farms connector, which is a collector streets standard from the Lake Hogan Farms development to connect up to Eubanks Road. And the site design, stacking, and other elements of the site plan itself currently present some obstacles to accommodating the 250-foot centerline curve radius. There are three primary standards that apply to the design of collector streets, and they are the design speed, site distance, and the centerline curve radius piece. And I've just got a table that summarizes this text. Our current standards have for the collector street have a 35 mile an hour design speed, a centerline radius of 250 feet, and a site distance of 250 feet. And our sub-collector street standard is 30, 200, and 200. The collector street standard for NCDOT in rolling terrain is a 30-mile-an-hour design speed, 230-foot centerline curve radius, and 200-foot site distance. And then a collector street standard from a very commonly used guidebook for residential development that was developed by the Urban Land Institute and American Society of Civil Engineers. Design speed of 30 miles an hour, 260-foot centerline curve radius, and the site distance. So you can see there's lining up here, 200-foot site distances, design speeds of 30 feet as well, 30 miles per hour, excuse me. But there's some variability with regard to the centerline curve radius.
Yeah.
And the way these things play out on the ground is that horizontal curves and the centerline curve radius are described by this radius of the circle, and you draw the street on the edge of that circle, and how that affects the development or your experience if you're traveling on the road is that how it affects your site distance. So there's the relationship there. And then site distance specifically as a design standard is the minimum distance at which a driver can see an object 2 feet above the road on the crest of a hill. And so this is the distance that we're setting as you need to be able to see this at 200 feet. The benefits and limitations of the proposed change, reducing the design speed does bring the design speed closer to the posted speed limit. It has been the practice of the town and many other jurisdictions, although this is changing, to post speed limits 10 miles below the design speed. A benefit of this closer connection is that more drivers are expected to travel at the design, closer to the design speed and perhaps even closer to the posted speed limit for these streets. And the effect of that is then that traffic speeds on these streets are expected to be reduced. A limitation is that that safety factor that's built in by creating a 10-foot kind of cushion between the design speed and the posted speed limit, that cushion is then reduced by 5 miles per hour. Reducing the minimum centerline curve radius can reduce the land area that's needed to construct streets. The environmental impact of the construction of the street can be reduced as a result of that, and vehicle speeds are reduced as well by changing this curve radius because of the way it affects people's comfort level and their sight distance when they're traveling, that is their horizontal sight distance. Depending on the site conditions, the horizontal sight distance is reduced, and so that can be a limitation as well. Drivers can feel less comfortable traveling at higher speeds. Some folks can see that as a limitation. The Planning Board and the TAB have taken a look at this. The Planning Board was able to conclude its review, and the TAB is still considering the draft ordinance. The Planning Board has recommended adoption, as does the staff. The TAB is still, the review is still pending. So the board could wait for the TAB to make its complete its review if they so desired, and that would give the time for the TAB to do that.
Ms. Kist.
Is it a timing issue that the TAB has yet to consider the ordinance?
Well, they've had a lot on their plate lately dealing with street connectivity issues and neighborhood. A lot of issues they've has been taken. I mean, their meetings have been very full.
Okay.
School road.
What does this do to the school district's time schedule as the board has asked us to expedite this project and everything that is a little bit of a bump in the road for them?
Well, I think at a minimum, the board would want to take action on this in conjunction with or prior to the action that would be taken on for the school.
When is the school conditional use permit application scheduled to come back to the board?
It's coming back for the formal public hearing
January
the 9th, and we've all been working towards the desire to have that actually approved that night, and that's the reason for the next item on the agenda to give you all a preview.
Okay.
Right.
And if I misspoke with Mike or Bill or Ken, I know you'll jump in.
I did not, I mean, I was at the meeting of the TAB, and correct me, Dale, I did not hear any major concerns regarding this item. So I, if you're comfortable, I thought we approved this thing, actually. Would you please remind me the outcome of the meeting? I thought we deal with this issue.
I'll do a mea culpa. I meant to bring it up to the TAB to make sure it came to a vote and failed to do so. So that's the reason why they didn't take action. We did it when we had a full agenda, as you know, that night.
Right.
Aren't they meeting Thursday, though?
A week from Thursday, they'll meet again, yes.
Okay. Meeting tomorrow, actually, at the RTP building.
Yep.
A week from this Thursday? But that'll be after
the regular meeting of the CAB.
That'll be after we're done for the month of December.
That's
with our meeting schedule.
It doesn't seem a huge deal. I'm comfortable moving ahead.
Frankly, it seems pretty, consistent with the line of thinking they have, and
it also doesn't cost anything to vote on this on the 9th. Yeah, it takes, and we're not going to need another presentation. We'll just have whatever information we get from TAB.
Okay.
I mean, there's no urgency to do it tonight, is there?
Well, the school had to request.
Right,
but we're not going to vote on the school until the 9th at the earliest, or well, presumably on the 9th.
We had originally anticipated that the hearings would coincide for this item and the conditional use permit application. They would occur the same night.
Right. At one point, both of these items were going to be tonight. If we were not inclined to adopt it, then the schools would need to know that right away because it would cause them to have to change their plan somewhat. But it doesn't sound like there's any real.
Did you
move it?
Without
option? No, I just said I was ready to move ahead. That wasn't really.
Yeah, I'm just saying it's
but
just
there's
no
Dan.
Urgency. It's just a courtesy to the TAB.
Yeah.
TABB has them.
Right.
Well, can't we ask the TAB to hold one meeting prior to just one very short meeting just to address this issue?
They have a meeting.
They have a meeting, and our last meeting is on the 5th, so as long as they're meeting before then, we can.
Right.
Well, let's either vote on it now or just put it to the January 9th meeting, whichever. I'm ready to vote on it. It seems to me that one of the problems with our planet is some engineers' propensity for focusing on changing the the planet, and this reduces that a little bit. So, makes it a little more acceptable to find the Earth rolling as it will.
Okay.
I think we should move this item.
Are you moving it? I'll second it.
Very well.
All right. So it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor?
The resolution, accompanying resolution.
The resolution of adoption.
Yeah, I'm assuming both resolutions are being moved by that motion. Is that correct?
Aye.
Yeah. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, matter passes unanimously. We're sorry, TAB. Agenda item B1, conditional use permit for Chapel Hill Carver City Schools preliminary review.
Okay, this is a preliminary review of the CUP for the Chapel Hill Carver City School Elementary School number 10. The purpose of this agenda item is to conduct a preliminary review of the Chapel Hill Carver City Schools conditional use permit application for elementary school number 10, a 30-classroom, 89,800-square-foot elementary school proposed on 19.035 acres, parcel at 215 Eubanks Road. Subject property is zoned rural residential and is listed on the Orange County tax map as number 7.23.C1. Formal public hearing for the project is scheduled for January 9th, 2007. Jeff Cleveland of our staff is here to give you all an overview, and then I believe that the consultants for the school district are here also to provide additional review information. Jeff?
Thank you, Steve. The location of the school site, if any of you have forgotten, up by Eubanks Road, off of Old 86 in the northern transition area of town. As you all know, you have requested an expedited review of the school, and the staff and the various reviewers have been working madly to meet the goals of the expedited review. And this is a little bit of a status, and these are some issues you may wish to discuss with the applicant, but you certainly don't have to. It's more of the kind of things that we're wrestling with and some points of discussion. In particular, the county is not committed to voluntary annexation. There's a considerable off-site sewer extension. This may have some questions of concern for you. As far as the roadway improvements, the roundabout is proposed, and they are close to approval, but they don't have the final approval at this time. The stormwater system, there's a very elaborate stormwater water quality and quantity system on the site, and it's being reviewed right now. It's not quite there at approval stage. And
you mean by our staff or the engineer?
By the engineer.
Okay.
On this last issue, they're providing a greenway linkage, a very small segment on their portion of the property. It assumes a certain location of the greenway for the rest of the property of the Orange County school site. So this assumption may be wished to be visited by you. And it's a considerable alignment, and there's some information that we would like to see with that. So with that, the applicant has prepared a presentation. And if you have any questions.
Could I make just one comment? And this happened late in the day, and I didn't have a chance to talk with Jeff about it. But I do understand as of today that Orange County staff is preparing an agenda item for the Board of County Commissioners, December 12th agenda, recommending that this 19-acre site be annexed by the town of Carborough. So that's on the County Commissioners' planned agenda for December 12th.
Jeff, could you speak a little more to the issue with Owosso and the off-site connection, like what's involved in that?
Well, the alignment is an off-site alignment that connects all the way up to Eubanks Road. Here, let me get a picture. This will help slightly. All right. The school's up here, and the alignment required to plug in the school to the sewer system has to go all the way down here and then all the way to the Glen Ridge Townhomes sewer extension, which was approved as part of the Jones property conditional use permit. And the one of the issues is that the this alignment goes right along the creek, and so that certainly is going to attract some interest in the town, and we would like to see a little more information.
There's not an Owosso main, because I know there's a pump station down at I know there's a pump station on Old 86 coming up from McDougal, right at the corner of McDougal and I think Greensboro. So there's no connection, there's no sewer pipe running on Old 86 going north?
Mm-hmm. No. There's a water line that goes up
right
through this, and a water line that connects partly to here. The sewer stub out is right in this area. And if you look at the topo, it kind of, there's a drainage that kind of comes through here, ties together, and goes along this side.
And refresh my memory, there's not going to be, as I can remember, or is there going to be, is the county new waste facility that they're building going to be connected with water and sewer?
Oh, boy, that's, I'm not sure on that. I have a memory that wasn't allowed.
You're talking about the administrative
facility.
Right,
I can't remember if it's too far off or if it's part of it's in the rural buffer, part of it's not in the rural buffer.
I believe it's not going to be public water,
okay.
So water and sewer.
Which is really stupid not to have a public facility on public sewer and water, but...
I think it was an issue of the rural buffer.
Right.
An essential facility.
Maybe it shouldn't be there, but I'm being outvoted on that. Are there any questions for Jeff?
Yeah, I have another question to follow up on that. I've heard some concern. I haven't been up there myself, but that the west side of Jones Creek, where the sewer line is drawn, is actually the more environmentally sensitive side.
Mm-hmm.
And that from that standpoint, the east side would perhaps be preferable. Is that your sense? You're nodding, and that's your sense of it?
Well, not specifically. That's one of the areas that staff has identified as wanting more information to have that alignment, you know, demonstrate its environmental suitability. And so we've requested more information.
Okay, great.
Go ahead.
That alignment, when we're talking a sewer line, are we talking a sewer line with manholes?
I do believe.
Yes, you'd have to have manholes.
Which is what we have everywhere. For greenways and walkways along most of the creeks that I know.
Well, unless you're going to have more pump station, and because Owosso typically likes to have a gravity sewer, you're going to have a lot more, you're going to have manholes in a certain amount of feet to push the sewer, to keep the sewer moving down to the Mason Farm plant.
So my question is, how did that connect? I see a sewer line, but also I see a walkway, or we can make it into a greenway. Is that in alignment with the plans of the greenways?
Well, the greenway, off-site greenway, is not a part of their application, but the proposal is to co-locate the Owosso 30-foot sewer easement and the greenway.
Together.
Locate it together.
That's a good thing, right?
Well, it seems sensible. You're going to go in and disturb it. Why not just do it once?
Right.
And is 30 feet a standard width that
Yes.
Lots of users.
It is.
Yes.
Because they have certain OSHA requirements. If they have to dig up a pipe,
yes,
they have to have a certain amount of wide so that if somebody goes down in a pipe, the sides won't fall in on them.
And they want to be able to turn around their bulldozers and work on both sides of it. And 30 feet.
Any other questions? Let's hear from the applicant.
All right.
Good evening. My name is Ken Redfoot. I'm with Corley Redfoot Zach. We're the architects and engineers for elementary school number 10. This evening, I have two representatives from the school system, Bill Mullen, facilities director, Steve Scroggs, assistant superintendent. Also, Mike Hammersley, civil engineer with Corley Redfoot Zach, is here to answer any questions that you have. So, this looks different. Okay. I'm going to talk about the building. I know we concentrate a lot on the site plans, and you'll see a lot more of that and get a lot more information in on January 9th. But what I want to tell you about is the building this evening. The building is based on elementary school that was built in Meadowmont. The school is called the Melanzora Rashkus Elementary School. It's a school that was designed using the Chapel Hill-Carrboro School Board Policy 940, which is a high-performance guidelines that were actually now in play on all of their work, including the new Carrboro High School. This was the first job that was put in play under that ordinance. This building uses full day lighting. It uses rainwater catchment systems. It uses two different types of solar collecting panels, flat plate solar collectors and PV panels. And it uses other items. For example, in this aerial shot of Rashkus Elementary School, you can see the use of light-colored roof. In this case, it's a metal roof that's actually called a limestone color. The light-colored roof actually acts as a way to reduce the heat island effect on the school, limiting the solar absorption into the roof and keeping the roof cooler and the whole environment cooler by virtue of that, also utilizing EPA Energy Star roofing guidelines. The school is established into three academic areas, classrooms, basically a media center located here, the main entrance to the school here, an array of support offices through this area, and then this wing that juts out basically houses the community gymnasium and the dining area or cafeteria area. This is the kitchen at this point right here.
But that won't be as large as a gymnasium because there was an agreement with the town.
I was just going to mention that, but you mentioned it first. So the difference between the reuse of the Rashkus plan and elementary school number 10, which I hope soon will have a different name than elementary school number 10, we're going to change it to a multi-purpose room. So it will be a smaller wing that projects out in this direction. Those plan changes have already been done and incorporated into the documents that you are reviewing. This shows you a typical classroom, 30 classrooms in this building. Every one of the classrooms utilizes full daylighting during the course of the day. So on a bright sunny day, which we have many of those, fortunately, in the state of North Carolina, especially in Chapel Hill and Carrboro, we have wonderful light that basically permeates and then lessens the need for artificial light. And you can see the wonderful light that comes in. We use light baffles in the rooms to diffuse the natural light to provide for a less glary, more diffuse workstation light. The way that we do that is by using dormers. The primary daylighting is used in north and south-facing dormer windows. It shows in this section right here. A classroom, the hall between, the light coming in from the south side, the light coming in from the north side. This is actually the way the dormers are constructed. This is another shot of a different classroom showing the daylighting coming in. Also, daylighting is utilized in the gymnasium area, the cafeteria area, and also the art room area. So anywhere that we could incorporate the daylighting and get those artificial lights to be used less, we went ahead and used the daylighting in its fullest potential. Secondarily, the daylighting is enhanced by porches. We created covered outdoor areas that basically run around the perimeter of the classrooms. That does two things for us. It provides, as I mentioned, a secondary daylighting scheme because daylighting, especially south light that comes down in beams, actually hits the light color of the canopy cover and then bounces up, actually adding more light into the south-facing windows. So you're getting a benefit from that light-colored, shaded canopy area. And then also, because we have this canopy cover here, we're actually increasing the usable square footage of the classroom. Because a lot of teachers on nice days like to have their kids outside if it's raining a little bit, or they want to take them out and put them out here in more of a safe zone. This extends the classroom right out into the outside space, and beyond that into a courtyard, which is basically this grass area right here. The daylighting is very carefully designed. It basically incorporates sensors that are high up in the space that sense the amount of daylight that's coming in, controlled through a interconnected and integrated panel of switches, so that the sensing device is actually in response to this device. It's actually calibrating the type of the amount of light in the room. It's actually sensing the light so that if the light level is dimming down, the artificial lights will come up and supplement the natural light. There's also a detection system, a motion detection system that's built into the classroom, so that as the classroom is used less during the day, folks leave the classroom. If the lights are on for some reason, the detection system will notice that there's no movement in the room and the lights will go out, but again, keeping the artificial light used at a minimum. Another remarkable thing that we've been using with the Chapel Hill Carver City Schools, not only on this project but also on Smith Middle School, is the use of underground water collection tanks. We take the rainwater off of the roofs through the downspout and gutter system down into underground tanks. Those underground holding tanks basically are used for typically two purposes. One is to irrigate some of the ground in front of the building, but moreover used to actually flush the toilets in the facility. This school, the Raskas Elementary School, has saved over 800,000 gallons just in the last year. The rainwater, basically, these are some construction photographs showing the type of excavation and the type of tanks that have to go in the ground. It's very carefully drawn so that there's a difference between the way irrigation water is handled and the way that water that's taken into the building, taken through filters, chlorination, buffer tanks, and then ultimately used for the toilet facilities. This shows a little bit more about the careful attention to details. Any non-potable or rainwater collection tanks have to be actually painted in a different color so that throughout the building, students and staff and teachers will know if they're confronted with this that this is a non-potable water source. As a matter of fact, we are going to open up one of the mechanical room doors. We're going to introduce a glass window, so that will become a display for students, because obviously a school like this has many sustainable aspects. It also has educational aspects as well, and we want to take full advantage of that. Also, I mentioned the use of PV panels and solar panels. Flat plate solar collectors are what we're showing in this particular slide. This is actually shown on the Smith Middle School. I'll show you the actual array of them that's going to happen on the elementary school. These flat plate solar collectors are pretty straightforward, and what they do is they are used as a preheating system for kitchen hot water. They basically boost the temperature of the water that's used in the domestic hot water tank and then basically allow for less energy to be used to heat the water up to kitchen temperature. This is actually a photograph of the flat plate solar collectors on the Raskas Elementary School, of course, facing to the south, properly oriented in terms of their angle to the sun. The lower bank of collectors is basically, those are the photovoltaic system right here. On this school, the PV panels will be used, and basically the energy that we get from the sun converted into electrical current will be put back into the grid of the building. These are schematics right here, engineering schematics of the way that the product works. Those are some of the sustainable or high-performance aspects of the building. From an appearance point of view, basically we have, this is the main entrance of the school. Main entrance of the school. Obviously, we'll have a different name there, and it won't be elementary school number 10, I hope. The media center is located right here. I mentioned that this would be the support or administrative office area right here. This, again, is more of a shows more of a comprehensive view of one of the classroom wings with a shed dormers located here, here, over each of the classrooms, that extended classroom space, the media center beyond. This is an important secondary entrance into the school. That will be the entrance that students use in the afternoon and the morning when they're getting off the buses and moving in towards the school and into the cafeteria or the gymnasium area. That is our presentation on the building, and I'm here to answer any questions that you have on the building, per se, any of the systems, high-performance guidelines. Also, Mike is here if you have any follow-up questions on some of the site issues that were mentioned earlier.
Go right ahead.
I love the design, the green design. Do this 940, whatever?
The 9040, the school
9040.
Policy.
Hmm? Didn't that include waterless urinals?
We on that school, we used 4 waterless urinals. We used them in the community gymnasium area. Since we're using the rainwater, that basically sort of diminished our need to use waterless urinals. But we did use them in that building in a very small sort of demonstration way.
What percentages of energy and water do we conserve with these practices?
I'm not as familiar with waterless urinals because we've become more attuned to using rainwater in our practice than waterless urinals. I know that the University of North Carolina uses a lot of waterless urinals, and on a project we're doing for the Durham Technical Community College, we'll be using waterless urinals there. I don't have any data to give you off the top, but I could get some
but
information.
But in general, I mean, not just water, I mean, urinals, but for the units. I mean, what's the experience at Ruskus with
800,000 gallons of water were saved in 1 year.
And how much are they using a year?
Mr. Mullen.
That was approximately 65% of the water.
Wow.
What about the power one? Unpowered. Do you know how much we save?
We do not have sub-meters on the throughout the building. We don't monitor the lighting versus the mechanical system. While Rashkus is very, very competitive with the older schools, the mechanical systems that are designed in newer buildings have much more high performance boilers and chillers to add into the system. They condition more air that's required, so they do more than older buildings, so that they are using more energy than older buildings. So while Rashkus and one of our older elementary schools are compatible as far as total energy use, the newer schools are performing at a much higher rate than the older schools and conditioning indoor air quality
that
at a much, much higher level.
Is it is it cost effective? That's my question.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it's cost effective, but it's difficult, and we haven't perfected our measurements. And submeters are expensive, and we put them in. We are thinking of submeters and maybe adding them so we can get an actual measurement on the lighting system that Ken talked about. We can see lighting systems on new schools versus older schools. But we're not there yet, but that's one of the things we're talking about.
Joel and then Jackie.
And whoever can answer this question, is it Owasa doing the negotiations about the sewer easements, or is it the school system? I'm just curious.
It's the school system.
Okay. And is it your, I don't know, whatever the picture is, to do it the way Owasa has indicated, because that's the most cost-effective way to do it? From where the stub out is, or is there another route that might be more environmentally in tune and more cost effective? I know that's a balancing test. I know they like to put them next to creeks because of the topography.
I'm going to let the civil engineer answer that.
Sure.
And if we can get that picture back up that Jeff had, that had sort of the overview. But what it is that, is, yeah, do you know how to, do I know how to do it? You're right in that the bottom two, the Jones property and the other subdivision in that lower area, were sort of given to us as to what they were doing in that southern part that
right.
we would hook to. And so that's what generally pushed us to the west side of the creek, that and the future park going in. your magic. So the fact that this property was already in and had their sewer already laid right. out and approved, and this subdivision here also did the same thing, and they all were coming down this side and doing right. it this way. So we're up here. And we already then came down to tie into the point there where mm-hmm. that would meet that property. So that's basically why we ended up looking at that side. Now, as I think Jeff pointed out, we have all of the survey up on our property all the way down along the creek up here. We're continuing to survey down along the creek through the park property because we're getting there ahead of the county. And so we get that data. And we'll plug it into what we've already designed along there to see the significant trees. We're already out of the 100-year floodplain with the sewer. We've made that decision and talked to Sungate about that, and that's our alignment now. We are staying out of that area. But then we would also assess whatever trees were along there and make sure that we pick an acceptable route that minimizes what we'd have to do through there. So that's our approach right now.
Okay.
And we'll be bringing that back to you to...
Right.
But the details when you see us again.
Okay, Jackie.
I just want to say that our community is always talking about energy efficiency and wanting to move forward, and just really proud that our school system has this design, and I think we're fortunate to have the architects that we do to design it. So thank you for your concern and attention to that.
Thank you.
I have another question. I was here for your previous presentation. You came for the planning board and TIB, and there were some concerns about traffic. Have you made any changes since then?
Yeah, we'll come back on January 9th with any updates on that.
Are you planning to consider making any changes on,
yeah,
on the traffic
all,
design?
Yeah, we noted all those issues, but I don't think we've...
You don't have a change planned tonight or anything?
Yeah, we don't have any revisions tonight. We're basically just trying to keep up with all of the comments and work with the staff and then integrate the different comments as we move forward. But our objective would be to answer all of, if we have any outstanding issues of particular concern, you know, we'll address those on January 9th, or they will be integrated into the drawings prior to the 9th.
Mm-hmm. Were there any of those comments that that make sense to you to strongly consider changing the design?
Yeah, we talked about, is it the issue, anyone in particular you want to mention?
No,
there were a few, yeah.
And I think we'll be getting more comments from the boards again in December, and of course we'll listen to those too and incorporate mm-hmm. you know, items out of there as well.
Okay. Dan.
Yeah, I understand that you're aware of the discussion that's going on about lighting standards that have come out of our Northern Transition Area Advisory Committee. And are you considering, have you discussed those, the relevance of those particular standards that we haven't adopted yet, but that are kind of working their way through the process?
Pretty
new information.
Yeah, okay. So we'll find out, yeah.
Okay, let me speak to that. I think that Trish and I did a review of their current compliance with those draft standards, and we did not find any egregious problems. There's some The draft standards have additional application requirements, and their particular lighting design does not trigger very many of them because they're using shoebox light fixtures. Very little. They're full cutoff fixtures. There's very little that this these draft ordinance require. The one issue was total number of lumens on site, and this their proposal has 33 lighting units, and the maximum on the draft ordinance is 70,000 lumens per acre. Theirs is at 36,000 right now, so they're well within requirement. So the staff has been looking at that, but we have not burdened the developer with that at this point.
Joel.
I just have one question for Steve. What's the estimated number of students?
The building will open with a stated capacity of 585. Now, that does not include pre-K classrooms, nor does it include any district-wide programs that may be assigned. We would have a 585 capacity as built.
585, for those of you listening at home, was the answer.
Just a comment about the lighting situation. I think we have to balance, one, not having too much light, but also enough light that it's safe should people use that as a community spot. And my concern is always, is there sufficient lighting if it's going to attract people at night? I mean, elements.
PTSA or.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, while I am empathetic about the light pollution out in the northern transition area, I also want to balance that with some of safety issues.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right. Well, I suspect we will hear more about that on January 9th. I don't. This is a public hearing night. This is not a public hearing on this particular matter. It's just a preliminary review of their application. I think it would be inappropriate to have public comment, I guess. Mr. Attorney?
Well, I wanted to comment earlier, I guess, that this process that we have that we're engaged in this evening is unique and I guess it's to some degree only semi-precedented by I think we did something similar to another public facility, and I think is not to be relied upon as a precedent for establishing that the board is going to do this in the future for all projects. I mean, this is obviously a unique project, being a public entity, that the board has asked for expedited review. Having said that, I think it's you can choose to do what you will with respect to either hearing folks okay. or not hearing folks. I think that there were people were notified that this meeting existed.
Okay.
And so if you choose
okay.
to hear some.
Well, let me suggest this. This is not a public hearing, and this was not all sworn testimony. So we'll obviously keep an open mind about this application and make our decision based on what we hear and what's presented to us at the public hearing, which of course may be different in varying degrees from this anyway. Let me ask if there are any members of the public who would like to speak on this matter, particularly if you could please come up now, and if you could attempt to kind of couch your comments in terms of comments to the developer, and we'll keep an ear open to what those comments might be. Would you like to speak? Please come up. And if you could state your name for the record at the microphone, that'd be great, too. Thanks.
Yes. I'm planning on being here for every meeting up to January 9th. One thing I wanted to speak on was you talking about the streets. I can barely get out of my driveway now. I will be directly across from the school on Eubanks Road.
Mm-hmm.
Going to the left is barely and barely, getting out. When you put this project in, the end of my driveway has numerously times after times has been torn up. I have just spent about $600 getting my driveway fixed again from what Bell South has damaged. when you talk about safety, at that intersection right there, what you're talking about, right where the school's going to be at, the intersection across from my street, at numerous times, I have had to call Orange County about safety, people doing things. This will be somewhat out, and I'm hoping that the lighting that you're going to use is going to be safe lighting, and that it will be more patrol there. And I mean, it's a welcome sight to the community, but hope that it's not going to be a great nuisance. And if you do get over on someone's property with them putting this school in, that you will be liable.
Okay. Thanks very much. Could you give her the pointer? Can you point to where you live? Up there? I'll ask her. Oh, and also, I'm sorry, could you tell us your name? I'm sorry.
Yes, my name is Marcia Tennant.
Okay, great. Okay. Thanks,
what
Marcia.
What is your address also?
206 Eubanks.
Right in there?
Right here.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. I thought I recognized you.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Good to see you, Marcia. All right. Thanks very much. All right.
Can I say one more thing? Just to keep in mind, I mean, the difficult thing with this to see it, which is not fair to you folks, but also it's not fair to the folks who live there, is that and we're going to be approving just one school, but we all know there's going to be subsequent construction. There's going to be a middle school coming up next, and there's going to be more traffic. And so it is, I mean, those concerns right now, it's hard to see,
right.
You know, when everything gets built, how Eubanks, you know, what adjustments. I mean, it would be good right now to start thinking of making, you know, taking into account those future adjustments for DOT and also for the consideration of all the residents there. And I think we know what happens with traffic when it comes to schools. You know, my kids go to McDougal School, which is, looks like a four-lane highway, and it does have a middle crossing lane and backs up. And I know Eubanks, maybe with elementary will be okay, but after you build the middle school, traffic will substantially increase, and I can see those folks backing up into 86.
Well, no, I was just going to comment and say it is a two-lane road with little or no sight distance, and I think that should be recognized because it's very wooded at that end because that's, you know, I go up Old 86 and turn right and go on Eubanks to catch the bus. So it's not a lot of sight distance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got to be, you know, either you're going to have to cut down some trees, which people don't like, but you do want people to be able to see, you know, where they're going.
Cut the trees.
Yeah, no, I'm serious.
Well, especially when you're talking about school buses.
Right.
Okay. All right. Are there any other comments from the board?
I have one comment. I'd like, on behalf of the Chapel Hill and Carver City Schools and Corley Redzek, we really appreciate you reviewing this project as an expedited project and the hard work that the staff has put in combination with our efforts to try to move this through to get the school occupied in the appropriate time frame. But we did want to say thank you for that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. And I think the board is also really grateful to the staff for spending as much time as I know y'all have on getting us to this point. We requested it specially, and I think we all appreciate it. With that, I think unless there are other matters from the board.
None from me.
Mr. Manager? All right. Well, then I think we're adjourned.
Sarah, I'm going to have to give this back to you.